And we're going to start off very easily with a course on complex analysis. So for most of you, this will be a refresher course. And I hope you won't be bored, even though it's a refresher course. Please interrupt me, because we don't really have to get through everything. And if you have something to add, I'm not an expert on this subject. I learned this by myself. So in previous years, we have seen that if you don't give this course, then a lot of students end up having problems doing, contour integrals and stuff like that. So there are a few books that I like. So this is Spiegel or Spiegel, and it's called Theory and Problem. Of complex analysis. This is not a very deep book. You won't find very extensive discussion on proofs and stuff like that. Yes?
So the lecture will be recorded and will be uploaded online?
Yes.
And how soon will it be uploaded?
Typically within a few hours. But sometimes, if the AV people are very busy, then it can take more than a day. But if it's not up by the end of today, let me know. Okay. So, but this book has a lot of problems. So if you want to do a lot of problems, then you can try this book. And some of the problems are quite involved. So it's good as a resource. A newer book is the one by William T. Shaw. And I really like this book. It's called Complex Analysis with Mathematica. And the library has a copy. It comes with its with a DVD or a CD. And actually, the whole book is contained in the DVD in terms of Mathematica files. So the whole book is written with Mathematica. And all the examples there, all the pictures and everything are generated by Mathematica. And all the codes for all the pictures are given there. And it's got some really nice stuff. For example, something that I want to mention in this course, you can use complex analysis and complex numbers to generate cool fractal pictures and stuff like that, like the Mandelbrot set and all kinds of stuff like that. Yeah?
Sorry, it's an actual physical book or a CD?
It's a book which has a CD in it as well. So, and the library has a copy. So that's a very, very nice book. If you want to use complex analysis to do numerical stuff, then that's a good book to look at. And the next one I really like because it's got the theories. But it's not too mathy at the same time. So it just starts from a very basics and then goes up to advanced stuff. The library should also have a copy of this book. And if you just want to see how complex numbers kind of weave in and out of different branches of physics and mathematics, mostly physics, I recommend reading Roger Penrose and his book. I think it's called The Road to Reality. I haven't read the whole book. It is quite the tome, you know, some people, so I just dip in once in a, you know, here and there and read stuff. So, all right, so these are the books that I like. I'm sure there are other books that you prefer. And so a little bit of history and motivation. Oh, by the way, has everyone been able to log into the SciWiki? All right. So all these the lecture notes are there. So I won't be copying this to the board. I'll just like write one line here and there. So you know, you can, and you don't have to take lecture notes. You can just, unless you want to. So, okay. So the history. So there's a typo in my notes. I found out this morning. Apparently, the first guy to consider a complex number was Girolamo Cardano. Do we have an Italian? No, we don't. So. In the 16th century, he wrote a book on arithmetic, and he had to solve this particular equation. And in one of the intermediate stages, he had to consider the square root of a negative number. And he called these numbers, or that particular operation, mental torture. He didn't like what he was doing, but he did it anyway. Apparently, he also got into trouble with the law because he came up with the horoscope of Jesus Christ. So, anyway, so as we all know, you know, if you want to solve this equation. Then you know, the general solution is an if this is the case, then of course this guy is imaginary and the solutions are in general complex numbers, right? So in some sense, complex numbers arise naturally if you are going to, when you're trying to solve, you know, algebraic equations of, you know, the most general type. So, you know, in this example, historically at least, you know, complex numbers arose because you were trying to solve a quadratic equation, but you can ask, you know, do we have to introduce something else? Some, you know, we have to, like, to solve this equation, we had to, you know, introduce the square root of minus one, right? But you can ask, what if I'm trying to solve a quartic equation or a cubic equation or a quintic equation? Do I have to introduce some new concept like a cube root or a quartic root of a negative number or something like that, right? And it turns out, no, you don't have to. And there's a theorem called the fundamental theorem of algebra. And it says that the complex numbers are algebraically closed. In other words, if you're trying to solve the most general polynomial equation, all you need are the field of complex numbers. Okay. So there's it's called a fundamental All right. You can't really do mathematics without complex numbers these days. And I'm not an analyst, but just an example. Say, if you consider the function now, this function has a Taylor series expansion like this. But this expansion only works when x, the mod of x, is less than 1. And you know, you can show this by using real analysis why that is so. But a much more geometric picture comes about if you just observe that this function has some poles at x equals to plus minus I. So if you extend this function, if you think of this function as a function of a complex variable, then you see that it has poles at plus I and minus I. And because the Taylor theorem the Taylor series only converges within circles, that means that this series only converges in an open disk of radius 1. And this gives us a geometric reason why this series does not work, you know, why this series, you know, requires the modulus of the variable to be less than 1. It gives a geometric reason, in some sense, because of the singularities, right? Now, in a later lecture, I'll mention how to actually, suppose you are given a such a series and you wanted to say, I want to find the whole function on different parts of the complex plane. Then it turns out that there is a way of doing this by a process called analytic continuation. And in one of the later lectures, we'll touch upon the process of analytic continuation. So suppose you didn't know this expression, you were just given this, then you could actually find the function in other parts of the complex plane by a process called analytic continuation. Okay. So, complex numbers give you a very geometric way of looking at functions. In physics, I think it's really quantum mechanics which brings complex numbers to the fore. So, if you go over to physics. We have and if you go to non-relativistic quantum mechanics, the Schrodinger equation is famously a complex equation. And a host of phenomena are related to the fact that it's a complex wave equation. You know, the most famous being interference, right? But there are other stuff such as time reversibility and charge conjugation, which are also related to the fact that it's a complex equation. So if you complex conjugate this equation and take t to minus t, you get the same equation, assuming that the potential is real. It turns out that the price you pay for that is that whatever particle you have to actually take the charge conjugate of that particle. So you have to consider antiparticles when you're dealing with the complex conjugate of this equation. And you can't really see that in this form. You'll see that if you, for example, couple the particle to a background electric field or electromagnetic field, then you'll see that from the point of view of the electromagnetic field, when you do the complex conjugation and the time reversal, you're actually considering an antiparticle. The deeper reason why that is so comes about from quantum field theory. So a lot of things are not really apparent in the traditional formulation of quantum mechanics, such as, you know, why are all electrons, why do all electrons have the same mass, you know, or charge? You know, those things come about very naturally out of quantum field theory. The other thing is that if the Schrodinger equation was not, or were not, a complex equation, this would be this is more like a heat equation, right? And we know that the heat equation is not a time reversible equation. It describes dissipative phenomena, right? So the fact that it's complex is very crucial to the observation that the processes that we observe in the microscopic world, you know, by and large, are time reversible. You know? I mean, we know that, you know, we have CP violation and therefore T violation in quantum field theory, but even if you're just looking at electrons and protons, you know, where there are no CP violation or time violation, you know, we see that the physics there is time symmetric. Okay. So because this is PI and people here do not just quantum mechanics for the real world, but also quantum mechanics for other worlds. I've heard talks where people have formulated quantum mechanics on not just the field of complex numbers, but on the reals. I don't know if somebody has done on quaternions. And you can actually go ahead and study the if what would happen if quantum mechanics, if you're only allowed real numbers in quantum mechanics. And it turns out there is a, you know, well-defined quantum mechanics, but, you know, things such as charge conjugation, those things are not allowed. So it doesn't describe our universe. And also the quantum information theory, very important, is very, very different in those kind of quantum mechanics. So a few years ago, Carl Bender used to teach a course on mathematical physics here, which is more—it's more like perturbation theory and numerical analysis. But Bender and Wu wrote a series of papers in the 1970s. I've forgotten to write down the date. But one of these, in which they argued that the quantization of the energy levels in quantum mechanics are essentially given by a energy functional which has Riemann surfaces, has many branches, and the quantization comes from making a cross section across that Riemann surface. So, you know, at the end of this lecture, we'll talk about Riemann surfaces, and you'll see that. What Bender and Wu argued is that the energy functional is like a car park, and so it's all continuous. But it's complex. The values are complex. But when you take the, when you cut it across the real line, you see these discrete energy levels. So quantization is really due to the fact that we have only access to the real axis. So it's, I have to stress that this is not the canonical way of looking at quantum mechanics, but it's a pretty picture. So. More recently, Neil Turok and collaborators, and I think Bender is one of them, and Jacob Barnett, they have been working on formulating tunneling in cosmology and reformulating it using complex numbers. So I'm not exactly sure about all the details, but that's something you can look up. These are papers from the last couple of years or so. All right, so then we have quantum field theory. And you can't really formulate quantum field theory without complex numbers. It's even when you're describing real scalar fields, which even then, you know, when you're trying to look at the masses and stuff like that, or if you're the analytic structure is very important in quantum field theory, especially when you're studying more foundational aspect. So complex numbers are integrated into the fabric of quantum field theory. And you'd think that all with all this talk about quantum, that complex numbers don't have a lot of application in classical physics, but it turns out that they do. So for example, you know, in GR, when you're studying GR, typically what you do is that you solve Einstein's equation in a particular coordinate system. So, you know, so you have Einstein's equation, which is Neil will tell you all about it, you know. I think there's a kappa T mu nu. And you solve it in some particular coordinate system. But the coordinate system will not cover the whole of space-time. If this is your space-time, the coordinate system will cover a part of your space-time. So once you've found your solution, you want to know, how do I extend the solution to the rest of space-time, right? And there, you also use analytic continuation, which is essentially which comes from complex analysis. And there aren't too many places where you can find a discussion on this. So the only place that I could find is Brill wrote a paper. It's an old paper, GRQC. So Roger Penrose used a generalization of complex numbers known as quaternions in his twister program. So he wanted to solve Einstein's equations not by looking at space-time as the fundamental objects, but as the rays of light as the fundamental object. So it's a very non-local way of looking at space-time and gravity. I'm not sure how successful the twister program has been in its original form, but it has had profound effect on many other branches in theoretical physics. String theory, there's a twister string theory, for example. And these days, there's a very active program called amplitudes, where people are trying to understand the non-perturbative structure of amplitudes of quantum field theory in four dimensions, and that uses the twisters in an essential way. So, for example, in this building, Freddy Cacciato works on amplitudes. So, and lastly, but not least, string theory. Now, the string theory is a theory of two-dimensional surfaces. So, a string, when it moves through space-time, you know, sweeps out a two-dimensional surface. And one of the things that you do in the path integral approach to quantum field theory is that you analytically continue to a space-time which has Euclidean signature. So the path integral in string theory is actually a sum. It's formally a sum over Riemann surfaces, two-dimensional Riemann surfaces with different complex structures. So, so in the when you actually analytically continue your theory to Euclidean signature, the world sheet of the strings, they become Riemann surfaces. So, for example, the tree diagram becomes a sphere. So essentially, you know, a string coming in and interacting with another string and going out, you know, there's a map that maps it to a Riemann sphere with four punctures in it. And then in the perturbation expansion, you know, the next thing is something like this, right? So it has this maps to a genus one torus. And there are two holes and there are higher genus stuff. And in string theory, you can show that when you think of the torus as a complex manifold, there are more than one complex structure. There is actually an infinity of complex structures on this. So in string theory, you have to find the, for consistency, you have to sum over all the different complex structures on it. So the whole complex analysis is built into the structure of string theory. So this is the spaced, this is the world sheet point of view. But string theory is famously lives in 10 dimensions, or the superstring theory. Unfortunately, we don't. So we have to subtract 6 from 10 to get 4. But that subtraction procedure tells us that the extra 6 dimensions have to be compactified or hidden away in these very special manifolds called Calabi-Yau manifolds. And these manifolds are, again, examples of complex manifolds. And the complex structure, I haven't really told you what it is, but it's kind of a generalization of the metric. The metric can be seen as a real structure, but there is something analogous called a complex structure. But on the Calabi-Yau manifold, you know, the complex structure on a Calabi-Yau manifold here might be different from the complex structure here. So as you move through space, every point there's a 6-dimensional Calabi-Yau manifold, and the complex structure might change continuously. And that manifests in our 4-dimensional space-time as a complex scalar field. So in principle, if string theory is true, we should be able to see the quanta of this complex scalar field as scalar particles. So in some sense, the complex geometry of these hidden dimensions manifest themselves as particles in real world. Of course, we don't see these particles, and that's one of the big problems that is facing string theory. And you have to go to some picture called landscape, which is, you know, a story for another day. All right, so this is my list. Any one of you want to contribute something else to this list of why complex numbers are useful? No? I just think they're useful because they're very cool. You know? All right? So that was the exciting part of the lecture. And the basics. I think you probably, all of you, know the basics, right? Do you want me to go through the addition, you know, multiplication, assumptions, and stuff like that? Anyone? I will. I mean, there's no problem. We have enough time. So, okay. Maybe what we can do is that we can start with the idea of conjugation, right? So if you're given a complex number, we can always write it in terms of two real numbers. So A and B are real numbers, right? Then we can define a complex conjugation, Z star or Z bar, as A minus IB, right? So this is useful for one very important operation. And the operation is division. So it turns out that if you come up with an algebra, whatever rules you devise for the algebra, you can't always define division in your algebra. And you can show, it has been shown that there are only four types of algebras in the world. By world, I mean the Platonic world, which these algebras are called division algebras. And the real numbers, they are an example of the division algebra, and the complex numbers are also an example of a division algebra. So a division algebra is an algebra in which is closed under division. So if you take a complex number, say z1, and you divide it by z2, then this is also a complex number. And to show this, what you do is that you multiply this thing by 1. So you take the complex conjugate of the denominator and multiply it, both the numerator and denominator, by it. So, and if you do the algebra, then you can show that you have some real number here, which depends on the real numbers that make up z1 and z2 times I, another real number, number 1, another real number, number 2. And because you can do that, then you show that that this is closed under division. If you haven't looked into it, I encourage you to look into the story behind the discovery of the division algebra known as the quaternions. The quaternions are represented by H, not Q. Does anyone know why? Hamilton, yes. Hamilton discovered it, and it's named after Hamilton. But the story is, it came to him, while he was crossing a bridge. Was it in Ireland? I think Ireland, right? And he was so excited, he took out his pocket knife and carved the formula into the side of the bridge, and I think it's still there. So the quaternions are a generalization of the complex numbers where, a particular quaternion is given by, it has a real part and, in some sense, three complex part, where I, J, K each they each satisfy this. But it's not a commutative algebra. They satisfy this rule. So you can even generalize the quaternions to octonions, which is also a division algebra. But the octonions are not commutative. But they're also not associative. So the quaternions turn out to be they're associative. So they're pretty, as far as things go, they are tame beasts. But the quaternions, they are not even associative. Okay. So the way to see this, to kind of organize these four division algebra is to say that the real numbers, They're an ordered set. They are commutative. Their multiplication is commutative and associative. The complex numbers, you drop the assumption of ordering, because as we shall see soon, two complex numbers can have the same magnitude, but they're distinct. So there is no strict ordering in complex numbers. So when you go to the quaternions, you drop the assumption of commutativity. And when you go there to Octonians, you drop the assumption of associativity. And if you go even further, then you drop the assumption of existence. So that's a joke I stole from an Oxford mathematician. All right, so we all know how complex conjugation works. If you complex conjugate twice, you get the same thing. I'm just writing these two for completeness, i.e. to kill time. And then we can define the modulus of a complex number as being the positive square root. Well, I guess this is positive by definition. And if you write it in terms of the real part of Z, this is what we get, right? So complex numbers have very rich geometry, right? And that's why we want to represent them on a plane. And this plane is called the Argand Wessel plane. And the thing to do is to, this is the real axis, the real part of the complex number, and this is the imaginary part of the complex number. Sorry. And if this is the complex number, you know, this becomes our A, and this becomes our B. And then the addition of complex number just becomes, if you represent the complex number as a two-dimensional vector, then the addition of two complex numbers just becomes the addition of two vectors, right? Very, very easy. The multiplication of complex numbers also has a geometrical meaning, and that probably something you haven't thought about before, so I'll just write it. So one side note, in today's tutorial, we'll be doing some problems. One problem will be, we'll do a problem on Riemann surfaces. And it'll assume a few things that will actually only be covered tomorrow, in tomorrow's lecture. And but I think you probably know all of those things. So one of the things that we'll assume is I'll assume that you know what the definition of an analytic or a holomorphic function is. And the other thing that we'll assume is that when you're doing complex analysis, the point at infinity is actually a point that you include in your set of complex numbers, right? And often if you're studying a function at infinity, what you do is that you do this variable transformation. And then we write the function in terms of the new variable. And then to study the property of the function at infinity, you study the property of the function as a function of omega at omega equals to 0. So nothing very serious, but I just wanted to mention that those things will be. Usually the tutorial happened on the second day, but this year scheduling kind of got messed up. Okay, so multiplication of complex numbers. So if you have two complex numbers, Z1 and Z2, then the multiplication has this interpretation. So if you draw the triangle, which consists of 0, 1, and Z1. And if you, so suppose Z2 is somewhere here. And if you draw the triangle, which is 0, Z2, and then Z1 times Z2, then these two triangles are similar. So that's a geometrical interpretation of multiplication. And when after I introduce the Euler formula and discuss a little bit about it, this will become obvious why this is so. All right. So multiplication by complex numbers is very, very fun, a lot of fun. You can think of multiplication by I as rotating a number or rotating the vector that you associate with a number by 90 degrees in the counterclockwise direction. Right? So if you have some number z and you multiply it by I, so if the number was somewhere here, then you can interpret the new number as being rotated by 90 degrees. And you can show this very easily, right? So the question arises is that, is there a number by which if you had multiplied z, it would rotate z by some arbitrary angle? I'm sure you all know the answer, but I'll show it anyway. So to see that there is such a number, we have to introduce the Euler formula. Which at some point was used as a proof of God's existence. Not really, it was used to insult an atheist called Denis Diderot. So the idea is to write a complex number in polar coordinates, and this is kind of magical. The polar coordinates kind of unlock the geometry of the complex plane. It's just a coordinate transformation, but it does. There are mathematicians who don't like coordinates somehow. You know, they say, oh, general relativity should be formulated in a coordinate invariant way. You know, anyway, they don't understand stuff. So this is the A part, and this is the B part, right? So R here is the modulus of our complex number. And theta is called the argument of the complex number. So theta is the argument of Z. Now, if you do a Taylor expansion of the cosine and the sine functions, so if I say, okay, we know cosine of theta is an even function like this, and the sine is an odd function. And then if you use the fact that I squared is minus 1, then we can write, you can show a very simple algebra that this can be written as the exponential of I of theta. Okay. Oh, what am I missing? I'm missing R. So this answers our question, is that if we multiply some random complex number by e to the power I theta, you can see that what happens is this rotates the number by an angle theta, or the vector that the number represents by an angle theta. Okay, so to see this, you basically write z as r e to the power I phi some angle. You write it in the polar coordinates, and then right. So you have rotated it. So in the polar coordinate representation of a complex number, the angle theta goes from 0 to pi. But if you extend theta to the real number, then if you consider this to be e to the power I theta, but theta to be extending all the from minus infinity to plus infinity on the real number, then that expression that the Euler formula shows that this is actually a periodic function of theta, right? Because there's cosines and sines in it here, so it becomes a periodic function of theta. So in other words, the argument of z, when considered as a function of theta, which takes value on the real line, it's actually a multiple-valued function. And I'll explain shortly what I mean by theta p. By theta p, I mean that it's the value of theta which lies between 0 to 2 pi that gives us that complex number. And this is sometimes called the principal value. And often this is denoted by arg, but with a capital P. So arg with a small, with a capital A. Arg with a small a is a multi-valued function, whereas arg with a capital A is a single-valued function. Right. So I'm sure you've seen examples, but let me just repeat one. For example, I can be written as e to the power I pi by 2, and then it can be written as e to the power I 5 pi by 2, right? So these two things are same. The argument here is they differ by 2 pi, right? And there are an infinite number of these things. So all this machinery allows us to find roots of complex numbers, or roots of equations involving complex numbers. So for example, suppose you're given some complex number omega, and you have to find the nth root. So you have to find z, where n is an integer. So we express the complex number that we have been given like so, where k is an integer. And then Z then turns out to be the nth square root so thus we see that the number of distinct solutions of this equation, how many are there? There's k0, k, so there are n distinct solutions of this equation. And there's a geometrical picture that goes with it, and the picture is that these roots lie on a circle, that are equally spaced, each separated by an angle, which is this angle, and the radius of this circle is r to the power 1 over n. So in my notes, there is a more explicit example where one finds out the cube root of unity. Do I have time? Yeah, I have time, but do you want me to do this, or? Okay, people are undecided. Okay, let's just do this, because we have time. I like finishing early. At PSI, you will soon discover that lectures like to go overtime, sometimes a lot of overtime. And so in contrast to the usual practice, I like finishing early. So that you can.
What happens to the second lecturer?
Sorry?
What happens to the second lecturer when the first lecturer just goes on and on?
They enter the room and glare at the first lecture. Yeah, sometimes, you know, physicists just, when they start talking, they just lose track of space and time, you know. You'd think physicists would be more aware of space and time, right? Okay. Very simple example, z cubed is 1. So you can solve that by using the method I showed. Actually, I think. Yeah, OK. And so this is actually the cube roots. They lie on a circle like this. And if you call this guy omega, then they satisfy, these cube roots satisfy this, you know, this equation. And this is a complex equation, so you can take the real part and the imaginary part. And you know, they will involve cosines and sines, and they look very, very not very transparent. But whereas when you see them as an equation on a complex plane, you know, geometrically, you know, this becomes much more obvious. So okay, I forgot to mention one consequence of the representation of complex numbers in terms of polar coordinates and Euler formula is that de Moivre's theorem becomes very trivial. So de Moivre, who proved this theorem before the invention of complex numbers, or at least he didn't know of their existence, you know, he showed that for integer values of n, this can be written as sine of n theta. So this is de Moivre's theorem. This only holds for integer values. And why is that? Because we saw, which is implicit in the derivation of the root of a complex number, that when you take fractional powers of a complex number, that is no longer a single-valued object, right? As we did here, we were, you know, to solve that equation, we had to take a fractional, power of omega, right? And that's why we found out, and that's how we ended up with an expression for z, which had n solutions. So when you take a fractional power of a complex number, that thing is no longer single-valued. So de Moivre's theorem, if you write this formula where n is not an integer, then the left-hand side, you know, is not single-valued, but the right-hand side still is. But the right-hand side is still one of the solutions of the left-hand side. So as a theorem, this only holds when n is an integer, but that follows trivially from the whole machinery that we have been introducing. So for the last 10 minutes or so, let me discuss about Riemann surfaces. And in today's tutorial, we'll do a lot of Riemann surface, or a lot of Riemann surfaces. So Riemann surfaces, it's a trick to make a multi-valued function to a single-valued function. And the way that is done is that you extend the domain of the function in such a way that the resulting function is single-valued. So you're given a function which is multi-valued, such as a square root of something, and then you are going to we are going to extend the domain of the function in such a way that the function becomes single-valued. So before I do that, let me just give a couple of examples of functions which are multi-valued. Number one is square root of z. If you write it in polar form, then we have e to the power I theta by 2, or e to the power I theta p by 2, e to the power I n pi. So this is a this how many this is a has two. There's a multiple. The multiplicity of this function is 2, right? Because as you go from as n ranges around across the integers, this factor becomes plus 1 and minus 1, right? So if you introduce the inverse function of the exponential function, so let's start with this, e to the power I theta p plus 2 pi k. If you look at the inverse of this, which is called log, so we define this to be So the log of z is a multi-valued function. And you can convince yourself this is actually has infinite number of values for each value of k, for k being an integer. So, you know, unlike this guy, which only has two values, that has an infinite number of values. So let's look at this function and see what's happening. Now let's fix z and consider this as a function of theta. And consider a circle around the origin. of, you know, or whatever radius. Now, as you go, now if you draw a curve, if you go around this curve, then your angle goes from 0 to 2 pi. So the angle here is 0. As you come back here, it's 2 pi. But when you come back, but you see that you don't come back to the same value here, right? But if you go around twice, so your angle now goes from 2 pi to 4 pi, then you come back to the same place. So it's a multivalued function. Now, one way of remedying this situation is to say that I will take two copies of the complex plane. So, and then I will take a pair of scissors. It's all conceptual, but you can do it in real life too. And cut across the real axis starting from the origin in the positive real axis. And as I go around this, the origin, when I hit this red line, I will identify with this red line, with this red line on the second complex plane, so that I am, it's like a dimensional portal. I don't know if you've played the game Portal. And I'm transported to the second plane. And then when I come back to this guy, to the same point on the second plane again, you know, I will be transported to the first plane. So this, okay, sorry. So the first plane is labeled by the value, the range of value of theta from 0 to 2 pi. And the second plane, you go from 2 pi to 4 pi. Now, I ask you the question, what would happen if instead of going around the origin, I had gone around a circle which is not centered around the origin? What would happen? Sorry?
Nothing,
right. And the way to see it is if you look at the theta, what would happen is that theta actually does not go through 0 to 2 pi. As you go from here to here, you know, theta goes from one value to another, and then it comes back again to the same value. Right? And you could take the circle to be here. In that case, in this picture, the circle is over here. So you are actually going to the second plane, and going down at the in the same place. So, okay. So it actually. Like that. So this is a two-sheeted Riemann surface. There are two sheets. And you can do an analogous thing with this function. But for this function, you will need an infinite-sheeted Riemann surface. Okay. And there are more, depending on what a function, multivalued function you use, your Riemann surface can be very, very complicated. You know, in today's tutorial, we'll explore some of these Riemann surfaces. Usually, it's a very active tutorial. Lots of people get very agitated while solving the problems. Okay, I'll stop there.